program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Moeller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Moeller, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Moeller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Moeller Program. Today, we're going to be talking about the issue of intelligent design and interesting developments across the world in terms of school systems, school boards, in terms of the a label. In fact, just an innocuous label on books in the science field in Cobb County, Georgia. Something's going on here, and it is clear that the high priests of the Temple of Evolution are quaking. They are desperately insecure as they see intelligent design gaining traction in terms of American culture, American education, and, of course, American parents. That's the big thing right now, getting involved and coming to understand what's really at stake in this. We're going to have a special guest in the second segment and the remainder of the program, Dr. William Dembski, and many of you know that name already, and the rest of you are going to want to get to know him today, and we'll be about that in the second segment. First, a review of the news. The news out of Minnesota, another tragedy in a school, and this time a multiple shooting. The student, Jeff Weise, apparently shot 7 students before shooting himself, and previous to that had shot 2 other persons, apparently his grandfather and a friend of his grandfather. At this point, there is no motive, there's no explanation, and again, people are asking the question, why, how could this happen? This in a Chippewa Indian reservation in a school in Minnesota. Tragedy, grief, people gathering, lots of the same questions being asked over and over again, reminiscent of the Columbine shooting in Colorado just several years ago. Folks, let's just remind ourselves of what's going on here. There are a lot of people who are shocked when people do awful things. And clearly, all of us looking at something like this recognize that this is tragic, this is almost unbelievable, we can hardly imagine such a thing happening, but it comes down to the fact that there are people who will do genuinely, undeniably evil things, and a lot of this is simply inexplicable to most of us. But it is a reminder of what sin really is, what it really looks like, and just how exceedingly sinful it is when set loose in an individual who will give himself to such evil. Now, my guess is we're going to find out a lot more about this, and just brace yourselves, because what we're going to get next is a flood of psychotherapeutic reasons for why this young man did this this awful thing. And immediately already, I've noted in some of the media discussions that this is being blamed on society, it's being blamed on something external to this young man. But let's remember, a distinctively Christian response to this begins with the fact that evil comes from within us, not from without us. We are sinners, it is true. Of course, we've been tracking the story of Terry Schiavo and the situation, and since we went off the air yesterday afternoon, big developments in that case and tragic developments in their own way. U.S. District Court judge in Tampa, Florida, turned back the plea that came from Terry's parents for the reinsertion of her feeding tube and the resumption of hydration, and the bottom line of all that is that, humanly speaking, Terry's hopes for a continuation of life now lie with the Federal Appeals Court. That's the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's hard to tell where it's going to go. The judge in Tampa ruled that he would not grant Terry's parents' request because, in his words, it failed the test of a likely success on appeal. Now, all you have to do to start looking at that is recognize that this is a court who did not want to deal with this. A judge, I should say, who did not want to deal with the case, did not want to rule on its merits, and thus, simply on the basis of his own subjective understanding of a likely success on appeal, has passed it off. It now goes to the U.S. District Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit in Atlanta. And folks, just remember that time is ticking away. It was at 1:45 on Friday afternoon that the feeding tube was removed and hydration was discontinued. So we're talking about a human being breathing on her own, who is not brain dead, whose husband had determined that she is no longer living in a standard of life, a quality of life that meets his expectations, and by his own subsequent claim, her expectations. Remember that when he was pressing his case for a medical malpractice settlement, this wasn't the kind of argument he was making, but he is making that argument now, and according to the courts, he's the one who has the say. 19 different judges. How many of you heard that? All the discussion in the media. 19 different judges have looked at this. Folks, just remember what we were talking about yesterday. It goes back to the Cruzan decision at the United States Supreme Court. And once that court ruled in the so-called right-to-die case that feeding and hydration were to be considered a form of medical treatment, then in a very real sense, all was lost. And sometimes that's the way it happens in these tragic court precedents. We don't know what they mean until subsequent cases begin to flesh out the full meaning of a judicial act. That decision by the U.S. Supreme Court set the stage for where we are today. And there was a second aspect to that case, and that had to do with who could represent the concerns of a patient who could not speak for himself or herself. And obviously, given the integrity of marriage, the first argument was that a spouse should be able to make the argument, should be able to make the decision, should be able to speak for the speechless one. But the courts are really unprepared to deal with a spouse who is dealing in bad faith. And one of the interesting developments in the national media over the last 24 hours is the increasing candor with which the bad faith argument is being made in the case of Michael Schiavo. Obviously, for good reasons, we would want to privilege a spouse first and foremost, but here's the ethical, moral, and legal question. When that spouse loses credibility to speak on behalf of the speechless patient, cannot the parents or someone else speak for them? It would have been very, very positive and healthy had that issue been adjudicated by the Federal District Court in Tampa. We can only hope that the appeals court in Atlanta will now take that up and deal with it seriously. The bishops of the Roman Catholic Church in America, the National Council and Conference of Catholic Bishops, has decided that it is going to lead a massive effort to eliminate the death penalty in America. Cardinal Theodore McCarrick of Washington, D.C. was the spokesman for the group, speaking yesterday, saying that they will now stake out a comprehensive position against the death penalty and they're going to press it. They cite two recent court decisions, the U.S. Supreme Court limiting the application of the death penalty, of course, just a couple weeks ago, the decision against juveniles being executed. Of course, in that case, it really means those who committed the capital crime during the time that they were under age 18. We talked about that on this program, and not only the decision, but the legal rationale behind it, but also the decision about those who are mentally impaired that was made just 4 years ago. And so now there is, according to the Roman Catholic bishops, an opening to press for the full elimination of the death penalty. Now, what's interesting is that the Vatican does not claim that the death penalty is categorically immoral. It claims that it is immoral where there would be another punishment that would suffice to deter crime. Now, I find that a fascinating moral point of discussion, because it's actually then a more pragmatic argument rather than a principial argument, and it comes down not to the immorality of the death penalty, but to the, the issue of deterrence. I think it's an interesting issue on which to engage people, and of course there are those who, confronted with questions of abortion and euthanasia and embryo ethics and all the rest, argue that what is needed is what the late Cardinal Bernardin of Chicago called a seamless argument for the sanctity of human life. I think it's going to be an interesting issue to engage, and we'll be following that on this program as well. Big issue at Harvard University. It's not over an issue of ideology. Well, not precisely. It's not over President Lawrence Summers, although his job is still on the line. It has to do with dorm aid. That's right, a cleaning service in Harvard's dormitories. Seems that some students got together with entrepreneurial skill and with vision and put together a service that would offer cleaning to their fellow students, and they've incorporated. It's a major thing. They have a website. It is www.dormaid.com. The subtitle of the company is Because My Friend Shouldn't Confuse My Bed with a Toilet. Well, if you've been in enough college dorm rooms, you know that there could be some ground for that confusion. However, the Harvard Crimson has decided to respond with outrage. This is class warfare, they say, and I quote here, "Dorm life is one of the few common experiences left that all students, regardless of class or background, have to endure with a measure of equality. The egalitarian nature of dorm life helps to foster a sense of collegiate camaraderie and unadulterated respect for peers. It generates a level playing field that encourages learning between people of all upbringings. A service like Dorm Aid can bring many levels of awkwardness into this picture. For example, do two people sharing a double split the cost? What if one wants the service and the other does not? What if one cannot afford it? Hiring someone to clean dorm rooms is a convenience, but it is also an obvious display of wealth that could establish a perceived, if unspoken, barrier between students of different economic means." Oh, give me a break. This is Harvard University. This is a school that is elitist to the core. You know, how in the world do you enforce this kind of egalitarianism? All must be messy if any would be clean. Are they all going to eat the same meals? Must they buy the same food off the same menu in the same restaurants? Are they going to wear the same clothes? Has anyone ever been to Harvard? This is insanity. But, of course, it's the official editorial position of the Harvard Crimson, made, by the way, a fascinating news story in today's edition of the New York Times. Now, frankly, I have to say I've seen enough dorm rooms to believe that dorm-mate is a good idea. Congratulations to the students with the entrepreneurial vision to pull this off. And hats off to the students at Harvard who have enough sense to hire them if they can't clean themselves. But that's another elitist issue. We'll have to hold that for another program. Today, the issue is intelligent design. Our guest is Bill Dembski. We're going to have a fascinating conversation. We're going to invite you to join it. You won't want to miss it. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Ladies and gentlemen, intellectual confidence is demonstrated in a willingness to engage the issues. If you know what you believe and you believe that your beliefs are well-grounded, then you can talk to anyone about anything with full confidence. You can allow a full discussion of the issues. And if you really have confidence in what you believe, you can allow persons to raise all kinds of fundamental questions addressed to the very base of those beliefs, to the outworking and application of those beliefs, to the structure of the theoretical issues related to those beliefs. So why are the evolutionists so scared? As a matter of fact, if evolution is such a fact as they claim it, if it's such a theory that is undeniable in an academic sense, then why is it that they are so allergic to anyone who would question from the core or the periphery the integrity of belief in evolution? The evolutionists are on the defensive, and that's a good sign. And wherever you see that kind of intellectual cowardice and intellectual defensiveness, you know that there's something going on. And right now in the engagement between the evolutionary scientific world and the world of intelligent design, there is a lot of heat and there's a lot of light. And standing at the center of the light is Dr. William Dembski, who has been a professor at Baylor University and has now come to Southern Seminary as director of the Center for Theology and Science and as professor of theology and science. He's an incredible person with a scientific resume that includes a Ph.D. in the philosophy of science. He also has a Ph.D. in mathematics. He has a theology degree, a graduate of the University of Chicago, Princeton Theological Seminary. Bill, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Well, you know, when I talk about this intellectual defensiveness on the part of the evolutionists, you know, I see them really, really nervous about this.
No question. I mean, if you go back maybe 10, 15 years, there was a sense that any sort of criticism of evolutionary theory, it was just nincompoops, religious crazies. But there was nothing really of substance there that had to be argued. The idea was that we're in control, and if there's any challenge to it, it's people that really can be ignored. Now that's not so much the sense. There's much more. These people are dangerous. These ideas are getting into the public consciousness. The school systems, which are largely populist run, they're open to these ideas. I mean, you look at the percentages. Gallup polls over the last 20 years have consistently shown that the evolutionist it's a minority position. It's only about 10% of the population. But when you go to the academy, to the elites, it's overwhelming that they accept this view. And so you have this real tension between, as it were, the unwashed masses, of which I count myself, and these elites who thinks that they can bully us into believing a view which, when you examine it, the evidence just doesn't hold up.
Let me kind of track the intellectual history of what's going on here. And I think those of you who are parents and students, especially high school and college students, you need to listen closely to this, because we're going to talk about what's going on in the battle for the mind, the battle of ideas. And whether you know it or not, that's the battle in which you're engaged right now. But let's just talk about this for a minute. You know, Bill, as I look at it, it seems to me that the first Christian response, recognizing the problems with evolutionary theory, and we're going to talk about those in just a moment, but it seems to me that the first Christian response was to say, hey, we have a theory too. But at some point, Christians began to look, intelligent, thoughtful Christians began to look at the actual structure of the theory of evolution and say, hey, not only do we have a theory, a truth claim to make, but you know, the closer you look at evolution, the less credible it appears to be.
Yeah.
Now, what is wrong with the theory of evolution that, that intelligent design just nails at the very core?
Yeah. Well, I think what's happened is I think often we get this sense that science is this juggernaut that just proceeds, and that as we learn more, there's just less and less place for intelligence, design, or things to fit in. And in fact, what we find is that in Darwin's day, I mean, we're talking Darwin's theory. I mean, all of evolutionary biology, that's what's really at its core. It's this idea that blind, purposeless mechanisms can account for all this biological diversity and complexity that we see. In Darwin's day, the cell, the basic building block for all living systems, was basically it was a blob of jello enclosed by a membrane. It was something very simple. Darwin wrote The Origin of Species. It did not address the origin of life because the origin of life was not considered a problem. Nowadays, the origin of life, it's the biggest problem there is because you have the way we think of cells these days are as automated factories in which everything is automated. If you want to, you have to deliver proteins to various spots in the cell. And those to deliver it, they have to have, as it were, UPS labels, you know, which tell it where to go. I mean, it's an incredible automated system. Nothing like anything that we've invented. I mean, name your most complicated human artifact, a General Motors assembly plant, a Hubble Space Telescope. What's going on in the very simplest cell is more complex than what we're dealing with. Now, the thing is, I think what has happened historically is that the Darwinists come along and they say, look, our intuitions about design are wrong. Design, you know, when we look at biological systems, we think design, but when we do the analysis, then we find that, in fact, they're not designed. And so
okay.
Darwin's theory.
Professor, hold on just a minute. Just so we can make sure folks are tracking with us. Let's just go back to the argument from design for a moment. In other words, when we look at the cosmos, let's just not take the entire universe. Let's just take the human eye.
Right.
When we look at the human eye, we're talking about a very complex architecture.
Yeah.
We're talking about things that have to work in a precise way in order for sight to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the design inference means when you look at that, it suggests someone did this. Some mind envisioned, thought, and structured this. And you're saying that the evolutionist says wrong. That's the wrong inference to draw.
Right. What they're saying is that in fact it came about by a gradual, purposeless process, and that there was nothing, there was no intelligence involved there. Now, what they do is though, I mean, this is the move I think you have to see. They don't have an explanation of, I mean, eyes have to be built in embryological development. It's not that just eyes pop up. What they want to say is that we have all these different eyes out there of varying levels of complexity. Slap them on a table. We'll draw arrows from the less complex to the more complex. We've got everything from light-sensitive spots to full mammalian eyes. And there it is. That's how it evolved. But they give no explanation of what has to happen in the genetics, what has to happen in embryological development, because these eyes have to be built. And
okay,
so,
now let's go back to the cell for just a minute, because let's just assume that there are going to be a lot of listeners out there who are trying to figure this out. Some of them are right now in biology classes. Mm-hmm. They're in science classes in school, and they're being told that the cell is the little laboratory for evolutionary development. And you're saying, no, as I understand it, I want you to correct me here, but you're saying the cell contains too much information, too much structure, too much design for any kind of blind evolutionary process to produce.
Yes, and I think it's not just that our intuitions are telling us that, but our best science is now telling us that. Information theory, molecular biology, there's now good evidence. You see, this is where I think the evolutionists have had us. They've said, look, we've got this theory. You've just had your intuitions about design. And we're saying, no, we now have a theory of intelligent design where we can put numbers to this. We can track the information and show that you can't get this by blind, purposeless processes.
You know, Bill, one other issue that I feel like we have to get out right here at the onset is my continuing frustration with those who claim to hold to a Christian truth basis of thought. They want to hold to the Christian truth claim, but then they also want to find a way to move evolution into some kind of symmetry with the biblical claims about creation. Now, just to set it straight, once and for all, the theory of evolution that is now dominant in the academy holds that there is no design whatsoever. Isn't that right?
That's basically what it says. And then the Christian wants to say, well, we just can't detect it. So God is this master of stealth who never leaves any fingerprints, but God still did it. And it's a crazy juxtaposition.
Well, there are a lot of oxymorons out there, words that go together but are incompatible when you put them together, and theistic evolution is one of those oxymorons. I just can't come up with any kind of intellectual credibility for saying, I believe in creation and evolution. I just believe in a God who showed his creative wisdom through guiding evolution. The evolutionists don't buy it, and for good reason. We're going to come back with Dr. Bill Dembski. There's a chance for you to call and join this conversation. This is your invitation, 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mohler.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Well, in the High Church of Darwinism, there's an enemies list, and on that list are names such as Phil Johnson, Stephen Meyer, William Dembski, and Michael Behe, and Bill Dembski is one of those the evolutionists most dislike. They fear. Why? Because of the power of ideas. And the power of the theory of intelligent design is shaking the scientific establishment because it's hitting it right at its most fundamental worldview foundation, and that is its assumption of naturalism, of materialism in terms of the worldview, the fact that there is nothing beyond the material world. There's nothing beyond the natural world, that the natural world has to be self-explanatory. Whatever is the explanation for the cosmos has to come only from within the cosmos. And frankly, evolution is a theory, and behind that theory is a worldview that is running out of steam. But there's a political dimension to this, because after all, where the battles often come, where you see the issues in the media and the rest, is where school boards are discussing what's going to be taught, what's not going to be taught, how evolution will be taught. It comes down in Cobb County, Georgia, to whether or not the school board can put a label on a science book, simply saying that the theory of evolution is just that, a theory. And that all persons should look at the evidence and draw their own conclusions. Now, what is there about even just a little innocuous sticker like that that causes absolute apoplexy on the part of the scientific establishment? Dr. William Dembski, what in the world explains this intellectual insecurity?
I think one way to describe it is what might be called a consensus trance. There's this sense that we've got to keep everything together. There's got to be this monopoly of thought. And if we allow anything that is critical of evolutionary theory, suddenly we're going to be on a slippery slope and everything is going to go haywire. And, you know, it needs to be pointed out that it's not just intelligent design that's critical of Darwinism. I mean, there are people who take a more materialistic view of science and yet say, look, this reductionist approach to trying to understand biological complexity doesn't work. And so there are lots of weaknesses. I mean, if you just look at the theory on its own terms, you know, in terms of the evidences that have been put forward for it, I have a colleague named Jonathan Wells who's written a book, Icons of Evolution, which just goes through what are really the best textbook evidences for evolution and shows that they don't work. And so you've got the problem of evidence, the theory itself not hanging together, not explaining the things that it's supposed to explain. And if you don't if you allow this criticism, then suddenly you have a theory that's no longer as strong as the theories of physics. I mean, evolutionists, I've seen this actually done, where they will say evolutionary theory is as well supported as Einstein's theory of general relativity. You're never going to find a physicist say, you know, Einstein's theory of general relativity is as well supported as evolutionary theory. It's not going to happen.
That's a great point. You know, one other thing about this has to do with this theory of evolution, where you now have some evolutionists saying, hey, it's just a theory, but it's not a theory like any other theory. It's now a theory that's held by so many people, you can treat it like a fact.
Well, you know, I think this is a great fallacy, though. I mean, if something is scientific, it's not a necessary truth. It's got to be in touch with the evidence. And as our knowledge of the world changes, as our understanding of biological reality changes, then we may have to adjust the theory. I mean, there's got to be contact with the empirical world, and that's what you're finding the evolutionists are resisting at all costs.
Folks, that's why we established the Center for Theology and Science at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Boyce College, is to take these issues on. We're not afraid of them. And as a matter of fact, we say, bring it on. Let's engage the battle of ideas, because, frankly, we've got something that is scaring the naturalistic, materialistic scientific community. And, we need to get it out there. We need to talk about it. And we need to confront the fact that that we're the ones who are open to the debate, and that it's those who are so zealously fundamental about and fundamentalist in terms of their commitment to evolution who won't engage the ideas. Folks, this is your opportunity to talk to one of the leading scientists of the nation and philosophers of science about the issue of evolution. Some of you right now are either in school, you have kids in school, friends in school, you're debating these issues in the workplace. This is your chance to call. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We've got Joel in Cincinnati hanging on. We'll get right to him after the break, and you can join the conversation as well. 877-893-TALK. Bill, we have just a few seconds here, but the scientific community appears to be treating intelligent design like it's some kind of intellectual virus. You feel like they're just trying to vaccinate school boards against it?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think there's a savage lurch to try to bring this down before it goes any further. And I think if it does go any further, we're going to see something like a Berlin Wall crumble.
Well, we've seen it happen once. Let's hope we see it again. There were those who said the Soviet Union couldn't fall, and, they saw it happen anyway. Same thing with the theory of evolution. We'll be back with your calls. This is the Albert Miller Program. Talking about intelligent design, and it is the theory that has much of the world talking because, at least in academic circles, it has become the great challenger to evolutionary theory. And the great thing about this is that evolution has basically been in a position as a theory to cloak itself in intellectual respectability and to build a fortress around itself so that it seemed to be impervious to any competitive ideas. But intelligent design, simply on the cogency, the power of its argument, has been chipping away at that fortress, and it's been fascinating to see what's happening. Our guest today is Dr. William Dembski, who will be, in just a matter of months, very soon arriving here on this campus, as the Carl F. H. Henry Professor of Theology and Science and Director of our new Center for Theology and Science, a world-renowned specialist in intelligent design, and this is your opportunity to talk with him. 877-893-8255 is the number. We're going to go to Joel, calling from Cincinnati, listening on WTSJ. Joel, welcome.
Well, it's quite a privilege, Dr. Dempsey and Dr. Moeller. I am a huge fan, and as a matter of fact, I've been teaching intelligent design classes through our school district's community education format, and it's kind of ironic. I teach in our high school's library where they won't even allow your books to be in the library.
Hold on just a minute, Joel. They will not allow books published by Cambridge University Press to be in the library of a high school?
No, books I suggested were Michael Behe's Darwin's Black Box, Icons of Evolution by Jonathan Wells, and then one of Dr. Dempsey's books. And they, what they do is they will, after the situation in Ohio, they couldn't deny that intelligent design was scientific, but what they are doing is they're housing these books in the science department. And the librarian has told me that this is an unusual circumstance. There is no cross-reference to say that these books are in the science departments. What that is, we know what it is. They're under lock and key. So,
Joel, my guess is that if you went in the library and you did a quick search, you could find Judy Blume's erotic novels and other things written for teenagers in there, but not a credible book published by University Press on intelligent design. Joel, we know you got a question. Get to it, and we'll let Dr. Dembski answer it.
Okay, Dr. Dempsey, here's my my question is, I want to see what you think about this. I think that the idea that has been perpetrated here is a question whether evolution is true or false. And I believe that that is the biggest deception of all, because I believe the better question is to ask is evolution progressive or is it digressive? And I would say that all of the evidence shows that evolution is always a loss of information. Yes, there is change over time, but it always goes from a loss of information. I just want to get your view on that.
Yeah, well, if you're looking for evolution to be driven by blind material processes, I think you're right. There's a, you know, it's hard to argue this at length in a program like this, but I think one thing which was just telling to me, I was at a debate at Hillsdale College about 3 years ago, and the head of the sciences, dean of sciences there, gave a closing talk, and he said, as long as I'm dean here, intelligent design will never be taught. And then he was asked, though, by somebody, you know, can you think of one mutation that could actually be something that is part of a macroevolution that would drive large-scale evolutionary changes? And he hemmed and hawed for a long time and finally said, gave the mutation for sickle cell anemia. So this is something, I mean, that's degenerative. It's actually a one-point mutation which changes one amino acid and a protein. That's the best he could think of, you know. And this is just common that when you actually look at what these mutations do, they're either neutral or even if they help the organism survive for a while better in an environment, they have problems later on. So it's I think you're right. I think the evidence is that that the sort of neo-Darwinian mechanism driven by genetic errors, and that's what these are. Let's not forget. I mean, these mutations, these are genetic errors that they cannot drive a macroevolutionary process.
Now, let me ask you, Dr. Dembski, does this have anything to do with the second law of thermodynamics, with entropy?
Well, I think they're really separate. I mean, I think the second law of thermodynamics is very suggestive that things run to disorder. But what you're dealing with when you're talking evolution is you're not – usually what's meant by evolution is not the origin of life, but what happens once you've got a living system already. And so you've got a cellular context of amazing complexity which can do things, which can overcome thermodynamic obstacles. And so it's much more a question of information and what are these processes able to accomplish in terms of building information. So people are actually talking more about a fourth law of thermodynamics, one of how do things organize themselves.
All right. Very good. Let's go to Mark, listening on WFIA in Louisville, Kentucky. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Moeller, Dr. Dembski. I guess I have an observation and a question. I work in the field of science and engineering, and anyone who works in that field knows how difficult it is with teams of intelligent people to try to create anything that functions. It's just amazing to me that the people who work in this field, the scientists themselves, who should be very familiar with experimentation and the difficulties involved, are the very people who seem to think that, who obviously do believe that things can come from nothing without intelligence. So how do you explain that?
Well, I'm obviously talking to an engineer, and I think engineers realize just how difficult it is to build things and get them to work. Biologists don't have to build things to get them to work. They just have to imagine how something might work through an evolutionary process, and there you go. I mean, that's why you see these sorts of arguments, like the inverted retina of the human eye, for instance. It said that that's an example of poor design. But actually, there are good design reasons for why that retina is inverted, but they never come up with an alternative. Well, how would you make it better? You know, there's no specificity given. So the biologists, evolutionary biologists, they just get around the problem of having to account for how these things could be built.
Thanks so much, Mark. Let's go to David, also listening on WFIA. Welcome, David. All right, we lost David. He was asking a technical question. I'm going to throw this at you, Dr. Dembski. He said, what about retroviral insertions? What was he talking about?
My sense is probably what he's talking about is with the Human Genome Project that there appears to be a lot of viral and bacterial DNA caught up in there. And how did it get there? And wouldn't that undercut the argument for design? Because if you've got all this junk lying around, why would that be designed? And the thing is, yeah, I think you have to realize that the design theorist does not have to prove that every aspect of biology is designed. Richard Dawkins says that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of being designed for a purpose. We just have to show that there are some things that are clearly designed. We don't have to show that everything is designed.
No, as a matter of fact, I think you're even understating that.
Yeah.
I think if we found one example of design,
yeah,
we would have to accept the
yeah
whole theory of design.
That's right.
All right, folks, it's a fascinating discussion, and this is where real-life intellectual battle is being fought, because it's in the courts, it's in the schools, it's in the marketplace of public opinion. It's wherever people are talking about some of the most fundamental issues in life, including the question of whether or not the world is meaningful and whether it gives evidence of a design. Interesting times, no? We'll be back to wrap this up with some final thoughts. From Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Albert Moeller. Well, in addition to his work, he'll be beginning with the Center for Theology and Science here at Southern Seminary and serving as Carl F. H. Henry Professor of Theology and Science. Dr. William Dembski is also associated with the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and we've had several guests on this program from the Discovery Institute. Dr. Dembski, what kind of resources would you suggest to our listeners today? You know, where would you have them to go? I would think the Discovery Institute's website would be a good place to start, but where else would you send them? What books would you recommend? Yeah.
Well, I think if you're just starting with this, there's a book I edited called Signs of Intelligence with James Kushner, some really nice user-friendly essays by some of the key players in the field. If you've got somebody who's junior high, there's a little cartoon book that InterVarsity came up with, What's Darwin Got to Do with It, which actually gives you a nice little introduction to intelligent design. Also, Philip Johnson's Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds is a great, great book also for high schoolers. And then there's a whole vast literature. There's a website, ARN Access Research Network, www.arn.org, which sells a lot of these materials and has a lot of good resources, also some curriculum materials, and also a discussion board on intelligent design.
Well, our production staff is writing furiously to get those links down so we can put them up on our webpage. Folks, as you're listening, you can just go to albertmuller.com. You can go to the links and resources, and you'll find the very sites that Dr. Dembski is recommending here. You know, when you look at this whole issue of intelligent design, it's clear that something is happening. And, Bill, I want to tell you one of the signs I see. And that is that the trade bookstores almost always will have some of the major titles offered by intelligent design authors right there in the book sections.
Mm-hmm. Not just the book section, but the science sections,
yeah.
which is very gratifying. I mean, so it's getting out there, the word and the ideas, you know, and I think there's a huge issue here. Are we the result of a blind, purposeless material process, or does intelligence start it off? And can we get our handle on that scientifically? Because if we can, then Darwinism and scientism are dead.
And folks, just remember, this is not just a theoretical, abstract, academic issue, because the worldview here is so important, because behind the worldview of evolution is an inevitable structure of morality and all the rest, an understanding of the meaning or lack of meaning to human life and human existence itself. That's why we have to engage these issues, not only in terms of how they outwork in the specific theories and what's in the textbooks and all the rest, but if evolution is true, what must inevitably also be true as you apply that across the worldview? If we're just cosmic accidents, then there is no real morality. There is no real meaning to life. The ultimate result of evolution is the worldview of nihilism. But intelligent design reminds us that there is a designer, and that designer has a plan. And that's what we're talking about today on the Albert Mueller Program. We'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmuller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mueller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmuller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.